what's the thing that's really capturing your attention when it comes to humanoid robots?
Do you want me to say it now or do you want me to wait?
Say it now.
We're in a recording. Are we taping?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, shoot.
I told you it's a shittier Joe Rogan.
This is great. You got 30 seconds of me thinking I was not being recorded. So there, now you really know how I feel without me, you know, for camera. Gosh, I mean, where do I even start, guys? Well, let's just start by, you know, the TAM, the total addressable market. You can kind of view this through the lens of an investor, which I certainly am. Or you can view this through the lens of just maybe the most spectacular innovation and game-changing leap in technology that we've seen in my lifetime. So, which is just freaking cool, right? Either way, we're looking at what, close to half of global GDP is physical labor. So from an investor perspective, if you have something that has potential to kind of turn that world upside down, has there been anything bigger in my lifetime? No, nothing that comes even remotely close. From an investor's perspective, a technology that comes with high barriers to entry, meaning there's not only massive amounts of proprietary tech and integrated tech, but there's proprietary hardware. There are things that takes, in some cases, years to perfect. There's a massive amount of learning. There's manufacturing. There's logistics. There's onboarding. There's maintenance. So it's kind of like this weird blend of, modern day tech with kind of going back to the Industrial Revolution and like the invention of the automobile. So it's kind of like a blend of both worlds, where we look at AI right now, and in some cases, a lot of us investors are a little bit scared of the creative destructionism that's likely coming in the early stage AI space, because we can't really properly define all the barriers to entry and where the moats are in AI and the extent to which AI itself will kind of displace a lot of the tools and a lot of the great technology oriented startups that we're seeing. So there's like more questions than answers, but with embodied AI robots, humanoids in this case, it's very simple to understand that technology aside, there are just massive, massive moats in this space for those that are early, have access to the right type of capital, and are willing to move and think really big, right? And I think that's why these few companies that have all the eyeballs on them in this space, whether it's companies like Tesla and Optimus or Figure AI, Brett over there, or, you know, Jeff Cardenas at Aptronik. I think that's why these companies are so interesting as an investor, because it's very clear to see the gap that's coming in the next few years between the leaders in this space and everyone else, and the value that you're going to see with those leaders. It's just, I've never seen anything like it. But also just from, I mean, you guys have seen the videos, obviously, right? Have you had any one-on-one time with any of the humanoid bots this last year?
Nope.
So I've been really fortunate to have some one-on-one time with a couple of the leading humanoid bots, including very recently. And, you know, in both those instances, it almost brought tears to my eyes, because I saw things that I thought I would never see in my lifetime. And I saw things that the world hasn't seen yet in any video. And the people that were around me, even those people had seen things like a month earlier, and they're like, I can't believe what's happened in the last month, right? And, you know, the things that we thought we saw, for example, at Tesla's big, you know, show in LA a few weeks ago, is really nothing compared to what we saw, right? And the things that I'm hearing that are happening at Tesla are way more, even at that company, are way more impressive with Optimus than what we saw, right, a few weeks ago. So it's not like company A is doing something that company B or company C won't be able to do or aren't doing. It's like we have a few of these companies that are just doing things that are mind melting with these humanoid bots. And it's so, you know, if you would have asked me like 7-8 months ago, like, what's the probability that these humanoids are going to be doing these spectacular things, things that we never would have imagined, I would have been like 96%, 97%. If you ask me right now, it's 100%. Like, I've already kind of saw enough of it to where the pathway is just so clear, like the roadmap getting from what I saw to what truly is the actual end game. There's nothing that is going to stop it from happening. I'm convinced of that. So this whole Jetsons future, it's coming. It's like I've never had more conviction in something in my life. That is coming. The only question is, okay, is it coming in 12 months? Is it 24 months? Is it 36 months? Are there a few hiccups here and there that take a little longer? Is it 48 months? I mean, that's still certainly open to debate, but it's happening. And damn, is that exciting from both just a human and an investor. And I want to say, like, as a human, like, not just because I think it's cool, because if you think deeply about, I've been thinking deeply about this space for 2 years, what it will do for humanity is probably the most exciting thing. It's funny because, like, you could look at me as a guy that's very money oriented, and that's like my entire brand is money. Or you can look at someone who knows me well, knows that I could care less about any money. Like, all the money I make, right, pretty much goes in my foundation, right, for charity at this point. So it's not like I'm trying to, you know, generate capital for myself, but it's really what it will do for humanity and our civilization. That's wild. Think about the concept of infinite human labor, physical labor. Think about what that does for, you know, aging humans. You know, I think there's a stat somewhere that says 100 million people spend a pretty good chunk of their prime years taking care of an elder person. And maybe not as often here in America, where we have this awesome first world society that we live in, although it does happen here, certainly. But it happens a lot in other areas of the world. Like, a good chunk of their life is gone just taking care of an elderly, like wiping their butt, which, by the way, is like a story that, one of the founders in the space told me at Aptronic was his primary motivation for doing everything they've been doing the last 7-8 years. Is he said that's not something that our future, you know, selves should have to do, or have to be done to us. And when you look at the demand for healthcare bots, just to literally take care of aging humans, it's easily in the hundreds of millions. Easily, the cost of round the clock care for someone in the U.S. is upwards of $175,000 a year. For round-the-clock care. So just think about that. How many people can afford $175,000 a year? Not many, right? How many people deserve that type of care in their older? How many people would we like to have? Every human on earth deserves that, okay? Like, I don't want to say deserves. We would like to be able to provide that for every human on earth. It's endless. Like, what could we build as a civilization? What could we do? Like, how many levels up can we raise the bar for quality of life across the entire spectrum of humanity if we had access to infinite physical labor? Just think about that for a minute, okay? And as in, you know, put the investor hat aside. This is big, guys. This is everything. So yeah, that's a very long answer for you, but yeah, that's why.
I love it.
That's why I basically, 18 months ago, I started telling everybody in my network that I was no longer investing in early stage companies. I'm not taking meetings with founders anymore. You know, I'm invested in, I think, close to 130 early stage companies. I'm like, I'm just not in that world anymore. I don't have time for it. I don't have mental capacity for it anymore. I'm focusing just on my public equity, social arb trading, which of course is what most people know me for. And I'm laser focused on this humanoid space. And it's going to be a big part of my life the next 5 years. So I made big investments, some of the biggest of my life in, you know, I'm very open about this, in two leading private humanoid companies, Figure and Aptronic, both unbelievable companies, unbelievable CEOs on both companies. And I've told everyone that I expect in the next 12 months to be placing what will likely be the most concentrated levered trade of my life in public equities and Tesla. So there you go. Like those are the big three. And I'm all in on this.
So as someone who has been following you for a while, I was somewhat surprised when I first learned that this was an area where you were going to be doing a lot of focus and research and then investment, since it on the surface level seems a little bit far afield of social arb and a lot of the types of investments that you've made in the past. So I'm curious if you could walk the audience through, you know, what is it about this opportunity specifically that, like, how did it get on the radar as something that you really wanted to pursue given your social arb background?
Well, let's just say before I started coining the term social arb, I used to call it information arb, right? So it's just information arbitrage. And that's exactly what this is. The entire concept of information arbitrage, or today in today's world, it's usually social arb, right? Because we live in a social digitized world, so it makes more sense to use that term, is identifying change in the world early. That change could be consumer behavior. It could be a cultural shift. It could be a brand, a trend, or it could be a change in technology. It could be a change in politics. It could be a change in anything. Actually, it could be a change in the weather. Okay, but you're trying to surface that change early, and then you're trying to connect the dots between that change and investable opportunities in the market. And there's a methodology that goes along with it that includes, you know, trying to assess the degree to which that change is actually going to be meaningful for that company or sector that you think would be impacted. You want to assess the degree to which the rest of the world is already aware of that change and has already connected those dots, in which case there's not really any arbitrage opportunity as an investor. You want to assess the degree to which there are other things happening to that asset that are more important than the thing that you discovered that you think will impact it. So there are a lot of steps there, but that's exactly what this is, right? So like this goes back to late 90s. I was mid-90s. I was working as a pizza delivery boy and a barback in a restaurant in Dallas, Texas called Chelsea Corner, a restaurant that I now own. And I was watching CNBC on the TV most days. They would have CNBC, they'd have financial news. And I'll never forget one of my best friends, Patrick Cummins at the time, had this a relatively small amount of money in Microsoft. I was really involved. You know, I was kind of a kid who was really, really interested in financial markets, doing a tremendous amount of studying into financial markets. And I generally thought the markets were overpriced, and I was kind of a perennial short at the time. It's good to go through that phase early in life so you can get over it. I watched my friend make so much money in Microsoft. It was imprinted in my brain. I was like, I saw that. I told him, I was like, I didn't really have the money to invest at the time. I said, I will never miss the next Microsoft. I won't do it. This is going to happen again in my lifetime, and I am not going to miss it, and it's going to make me a very wealthy person. And that's basically exactly what I did. So since that day, I've been looking for the next Microsoft. Now, that doesn't necessarily have to be a tech company, but I've been consciously trying to connect dots. And while I make a lot of social arb trades that are kind of short-term trades based on one piece of information, and yeah, I could double my money, I could triple my money if I'm levered in options and stuff, what I'm really always focused on are the big ones. The big ones that only come around once every so many years, because those are opportunities where if you just find one in your lifetime, it could be a game changer for you. If you're able to find three or four or five of them in your lifetime, which I've done now, wow. That could change your life in a very big way. So whether it was acknowledging the dot-com boom and sticking with it after the dot-com bust, where we had that creative destructionism, or whether it was acknowledging cloud computing for how big it could be someday and going all in on Amazon, back in the early days of AWS, whether it was acknowledging how game-changing mobile computing would be, right? With the advent of the smartphone, whether that be Apple or later on Facebook with online advertising, or more recently, AI, right? So those of y'all have been following me, you know that I kind of took a week off of my life the second I saw ChatGPT for the first time, I don't know, late 2022, early 23, and I just kind of meditated. And I was trying to assess where the play was. And I, you know, it seemed kind of obvious at the time, but I walked away thinking I can really only think of one obvious one, and it was NVIDIA. And I took a massive position in NVIDIA back in like January of 23. And that's kind of all I talked about for a while, you know, and here we are today. So it's like, oh my God, how did you see it? Well, it's like, I'm always looking for it. And I just, your brain has to operate in a different frequency. So that said, I met this guy, Jeff Cardenas, 8 years ago now, I think 7, 8 years ago. He's the CEO of Aptronik in Austin. And he was making these humanoid robots. And I thought it was the dumbest thing I've ever seen. And, you know, I talked to him. I was introduced to him through a fund that I'm involved with called Capital Factory here in Texas. And I was just like, this is ridiculous. This is kind of cool, but so clunky. And I was like, this is never going to amount to anything. And I remember thinking, I'm glad I didn't waste money on that, right? I actually invested in a different robotics company at the time that was more pragmatic and practical. It was a hospital robot on wheels, and it was like real, like it was actually really going to work. And I just kind of kept in touch with Jeff like once a year. I'd go to Austin and meet with him and talk to him. Nothing really came of it until about, I guess it was about 2 years ago. I talked to him for about an hour casually, and he was able to convince me that there was a kind of a hockey stick moment that was happening in robotic hardware. This is pre-AI, so it might have been 3 years ago, three years ago. And it had to do with actuator technology mostly, and also sensor technology and whole body control. And he was able to convince me that things were coming together, and this whole concept of having a humanoid robot had become exceptionally real. And he caught my attention. I still didn't 100% buy into it, but I did think that there was enough of a possibility that I made a small investment in Aptronik at the time when nobody else did. I mean, they had no money, but I made a small investment. And I started to follow the company closer and develop a closer relationship with Jeff. And what I saw happen in the year after that with this hardware technology really opened up my eyes to the fact that this could be very real. I then caught wind of a company called Figure in San Francisco because I had gotten to know some people in the robotics space that I was just chit-chatting with, and some venture guys. And we'd have conversations about Aptronik, and they said, hey, do you see what's about to happen at Figure? They're about to raise some capital. And I found out about the Microsoft OpenAI deal. And I was like, I got to be part of that. I have to be part of that. And I was introduced, and I made a pretty large investment at the time for me into Figure. And that round came together. I went back to Aptronik, and then they had a capital need, and I made a much larger investment in Aptronik. And here we are today. So now I'm heavily invested in both that companies, about to get heavily invested at some point in Tesla, solely for its Optimus humanoid division, which I think could be the biggest opportunity of a lifetime for public market investors, if my thesis is correct. And my thesis is pretty well outlined with my pinned tweet at Chris Camillo, where I did like a 15-part tweet thread about how Optimus has the potential to become a $10 trillion division of Tesla by the end of 2030, which I think is feasible. I think it's actually a fairly rational kind of like, I guess, exercise that I went through. Yeah. And that was back in January, right? So that was like, which seems light years away in the humanoid space. Like nobody, when I put that post out, nobody was talking about humanoids. And
well, we were, but We were nobody.
You got, yeah, but I mean, yeah. Nobody generally, right?
Yeah, we're nobodies. So, it's accurate.
the bottom line is this is such an exciting time. Now, I'm not allowed to really talk about humanoids in my house anymore because my wife think I'm insane. They don't want to hear about it. So
that is huge social arb information right there. Just like when there is something that you care about so much that people just can't stand hearing about it anymore. I feel like that actually is one of those data points.
Well, there's going to be a fight at some point because, you know, I told my family, I'm like, I don't know if it's going to be figure or Aptronic, but at some point they're going to give us, you know, larger insider investors the first opportunity to start getting some, you know, doing some feedback training in our house with these things. And I probably am going to be somewhere high on the list to get one of those. And they don't want it in my house. And I'm like, oh, come on. I might need to get another house just to do this. Okay. Like if you're going to say that we could be one of the first people
Chris is
going to
have two families. He's telling everybody
I might have a real family and my humanoid family like next door where I'm living half the time.
That's funny. So let me actually riff off of this point, because I think what's interesting about like the awareness of the human or robot, as Hans and I have tracked it, I've tracked it a majority through Tesla's unveiling and tracking that company. That's how I've become exposed to the technology. But I think there's two very interesting things happening with this. And I would love to hear your take on sort of the second point I'm going to make. So the first one is we've talked about is like there's very low awareness of this, it seems, just in the public zeitgeist. A lot of people still don't believe this is even real, right? It's like one of those things where it's very isolated. It reminds me, if I sort of go back to my investing in Tesla days, it reminds me of the lack of awareness around electric vehicles actually becoming a dominant form of transportation. It kind of reminds me of that, but at like a scale of like 10, 20x potentially because of how big the TAM is, right? So that's variable number one. And then variable number two is the usefulness of the technology and how quickly it can become useful is severely underrated still, even by the people that follow it, right? And the thing that opened my eyes is it doesn't even have to be a full AI solution for it to be useful. As long as it can balance and as long as it can be relatively safe and it can be somehow teleoperated or it has simple tasks where you can multiply the human leverage 5-to-1 or 10-to-1, all of a sudden, you have a no-brainer business proposition for basically every company that can do physical labor, and you're only limited by the hand motion and sort of the technology that's driving that, which is mostly solved, it sounds like, or at least it's going to be solved. There's a pathway for that to be solved. So I would love to get your take on that. Would you agree with that statement that it's going to be useful a lot faster than people that are even following this space think? And the usefulness of it will be so large so quick that it's going to take everybody by surprise. I would love to hear your take on that.
Yeah, I can say confidently that you don't even need an AI brain to do a tremendous amount of useful work with these humanoids, but they are getting AI brains. They're getting them like right now. Whether you call it an AI brain or you call it like a, you know, neural network type of connection. So I did some back the napkin math a couple months ago. I didn't spend that much time on it, but I estimated there's roughly, I could be wildly off, but I don't think I am, roughly 9 trillion box movements a year of like large boxes from like a truck to a warehouse, from the warehouse back to a truck, from a truck to a this, from a loading dock. And it's just like 9 trillion roughly a year.
Just FYI, that's my background. I come from a supply chain background. And like, that's the thing that sparked for me the immediate. Yeah. I'm like, bro, like staging and picking and packing is like such a valuable function in a warehouse factory environment. How could a bot not be useful in here? Go ahead.
It is.
Yeah.
And the thing, no, it's okay. The thing is, and so if you're from that background, you know that it's just so different at every single like rooftop, right? It's like so different. People are like, there's better form. Like the biggest argument that I hate, the one that just drives me insane, that's anti-humanoid. And I won't even say who it was with, but I was with arguably one of the smartest AI minds in the world recently, just having a chat at a personal meal. And this person tried to have that argument with me that he didn't think the humanoid, the human form factor was the best form factor. I was like, I was so frustrated by this conversation because this person was so smart and they were an AI scientist, but they were also kind of in their own world. And I think if you don't spend a lot of time critical thinking, like about this exact problem, you won't understand the answer to it. But every single application is a little bit different. And so you can't just have this random, like thousands of different type of bots that are AI bots that are working. It becomes a logistical nightmare and a training nightmare. And a company makes one little different change, and now you have all these bots that were for this one thing, that now you got to find a new home for them. The concept of having one bot that's basically in the human form, more or less, that can do anything that a human, like the number of jobs that a human does physically is just absolutely insane on Earth. Like the number of things we're capable of doing on Earth is wild when you think about it from a human form factor. And even one job that we do, how differently that job is done across every rooftop in the world, every commercial industrial rooftop in the world, is just mind blowing. And so when you put an AI brain or an AI heart, a brain, because the brain's here, right? It's not up here in these robots. When you stick that in there, and you could, it can take speech instructions and then map things out, and you could validate on an iPad what it's going to do. And you have an army of these bots just doing very simple, repetitive things that are not sexy, right? They're not that interesting, but they can just do it. They can just do the work, man. Like, so I recently had to, I did this little experiment where I bought hundreds of thousands of dollars of kind of like equipment for the hurricane, post-hurricane rebuild in Florida. And I donated it to Florida and stuff. And it was just like this whole project, but I had to do it myself with a very small team here in Dallas, buying dehumidifiers and generators. The amount of work we went through over a 4-day period was believable. It's just physical work, like getting these things onto these U-Hauls, getting them from the U-Haul to a bigger truck that was going to go to Florida. We actually had to stop for 6 hours and hire a moving company to come out to move it 30 feet from one truck to another. And it cost so much money, and it like really messed up all of our planning that day. And now, infinite human physical labor, guys, it's as big as it gets. That's all I'm going to say. It's as big as it gets. And it could be physical human style labor. It doesn't need to be. You could make a case that I can create a bot that will do that job 3x faster. I don't care. It really doesn't matter that much. Because if you could just do it at human speed or even 80% of human speed, and you could produce tens and tens of millions of bots to do that, and the second you don't need them, those bots can be rerouted to do a slightly different thing at your facility. Or if your whole darn company closes down, the next day they pick up all those bots and they're being utilized at a different company down the street to do something wildly different. The value of that is actually unreal. It's actually unreal.
Yeah. It's so crazy to think about. I think that point of, it's when you think of a human, humans, even though as an aggregate, we all do insanely complex things, it's very rare for one person to do all those or a majority of those kinds of tasks, right? Like, you know, I might have worked at a warehouse and I may have picked and packed, but you're not really going to like see me, you know, running a landscape company and maybe mowing the lawn for a living, or being a house cleaner, or being an assistant on a ship catching crabs, or whatever, right? Like you can go down the list of all, you know, even healthcare, just go down the list of physical labor, everything. Exactly. So even humans, as valuable as we are, as valuable as our labor is, we're not really that adaptable cross industry, whereas a human or robot is, you know? And so the question becomes is like, it feels like the demand for, this is like it's such an obvious point. And that's like the mind blowing part of this whole conversation is like, I'm still surprised that there's not as much attention to it, but I think the reason why it's because people are still struggling to really believe that it's real, that this is actually that, real.
That's something that, so that goes back to like Black Swan theory, right? And Nassim Taleb is kind of famous for documenting in Black Swan, his book. For those of you that haven't read it, everybody has to, whether you love him or hate him is kind of irrelevant. It's such an impactful book for investors to understand. This is really important. So our human minds will not allow us to process stuff like this. It will not allow us to process anomalies, things that seem too bad or too good. It doesn't matter how real they are. We cannot and will not process them. In fact, investors, Wall Street, institutional Wall Street, if they have something right in front of their face, and that thing right in front of their face is telling them this is going to 10x the size of that company, it should be valued at 10x where it is today, they just cannot bid up that company more than 2x. Doesn't matter if it's like, if it's 100%, they just won't do it. They just won't do it. We, you know, guys like me grew up watching the Jetsons, you know, and I don't care how many, do you know how many people have seen some of these videos? How many of the commenters are like, it's staged, it's not real, it's fake. And I get it. I totally get that. There's like, we've been to magic shows. It's just like, it looks so damn, we know it's not real. That you have to understand human behavior and human perception. The public will not believe this, even after it's presented time and time again, until it's presented so much in so many different ways and has had so many respected critical thinking names that are coming out saying this is real. I mean, it's going to take so much for the people to believe this, but once it happens, we will all look back, I think. I'm not a financial advisor. I'll make that very clear. These are all my thoughts, my investments. I always warn people, my tolerance for risk is extraordinarily high. And I actually have risk capital that's oriented towards taking bets that are exceptionally risky. So please don't go out and buy Tesla because you're listening to me speak right now. I don't even have a big long position in Tesla at this second. But we'll all look back and be like, gosh, that was so obvious. We literally had it right in front of our face. We had the videos. We had the, like, it was all right there. And like, why? And now we have these $10 trillion companies, right? And they're like, we say today about NVIDIA. What I always ask people, so why didn't you like put every dollar of risk capital that was actual risk capital in your world into NVIDIA and probably levered in, like, what? Tell me why. I'm just curious. Like, why didn't you do that? I want to know why you didn't invest all of your money in Apple when you saw the iPhone for the first time. So why exactly did you just not put all of your money into Amazon? Like, why? Like, explain this to me. Like, when you realized that all the world was spending all of their time on Facebook and then Instagram, like, why did you not believe in Facebook enough to put all of your money in? It's just like, we just don't. People don't. And so investing is so hard, but it can be so easy once you've gotten through that brain block and, you know, you can kind of see things for as they are, not let your mind kind of mess with you into thinking it can't happen. There's no way. Like, so I put out that tweet a month ago about Palantir. I retweeted it today, and it was a pretty bold tweet. I was like, every single person that was anti-Palantir, which is a lot, including people that had been in Palantir for a long time, were like, the valuation's insane. It's insane.
I was one of those people.
The valuation's insane. You're insane for having that episode I did on Palantir on Dumb Money Live. And they're like, you're insane. You're way late to this game. No way on earth. And I put out a tweet. I said, I am the Palantir's. I'm not concerned at all about Palantir's valuation. Like they're multiple. It doesn't bother me at all. Not even a bit. And now here we are today. That was at like $35 a share. I don't know where they are today. It's ridiculous. Like 50. That was like a month ago. Right.
And they're up 20% today after earnings. Yeah.
There was a reason for that. There was a reason because, like, you're looking at the multiple and not understand. I still can't wrap my, and this is all I talked about in my episode. I was like, Palantir has like less than 400 commercial customers. how are you applying a multiple to that? Like you, do you apply a multiple to a startup that's been around for a year and be like, nah, can't give them that multiple? What do you mean a multiple? They're not even, there is no multiple. Like, they're trading at infinity of their sales because they don't have any sales yet, right? So just assume Palantir doesn't have any sales at all yet, right? And they could potentially have 20,000 commercial customers, 50,000. Could they eventually have 125,000 like Salesforce has? I don't know. But I sure as hell know that using a number of 370 commercial clients, looking at what that revenue is in the first 2 to 3 years that they're in that business and applying a multiple to it is not even something we should even care about or look at. Right. So there was such a huge disconnect there. And that's why I said it doesn't bother me because I'm not even looking at it.
Yeah.
I want to jump in about Palantir, but
it's good. Yeah. I actually have been going through the learning platform for AIP and trying to learn how to develop with it. And I'm super impressed by it. One of the pieces that impresses me is that it is very intimidating when you realize you can do literally anything here. And in order to do literally anything, that means you have to know a lot. And so I understand why you need a forward deployed engineer to help you set this stuff up. The more that I dig into it, but also, man, even though it is somewhat intimidating, it's still way easier than any other. I've been dealing with business software for a long time now. And usually not at a very high level, but just the amount of experience that I have is oh my gosh, I wish I had this tool at my disposal literally anytime I ever had to do anything before in the past. And I've been an investor in the company for quite some time, and I took a small position in $20 strike leaps back when the price was 12 or 13, and that has done very well. I plan on exercising some of those options in January, and I'm excited about the future of that company.
Love it.
Go ahead.
No, I'm gonna say so many of us get distracted as investors and tricked by thinking the price that we paid for something should have any factor in whether or not we continue to invest in it or hold it in the future, right? It doesn't matter if you got in a stock at 10 cents or $200, that should play no part in deciding whether or not you want to own it today or tomorrow, based on wherever it's trading. And my biggest pet peeve in all of investing is the word hold as an analyst rating. There's no such thing. It's either buy or sell, right? So you either feel that I always tell people your repurchase, taxation aside, because yes, you can make a case that sometimes you hold something that you ordinarily don't think is worthy of holding at that price because you have 2 months left until it becomes long-term capital gains. So that aside, you're repurchasing your entire portfolio every day at the existing price. So people would ask me but would you buy Palantir at this price? I was like, well, I hadn't sold mine yet. So yes, I just rebought it today. I literally just rebought it a minute ago. A second ago, I just decided to repurchase Palantir. Every second that we're talking, I'm deciding to I exited my entire portfolio every second. And every second I'm deciding that this is how I want to allocate my capital. I want to own Palantir. I want to own NVIDIA at that price that it's trading at that second. Why is this so hard for people to understand? Why does nobody talk about that? That might be the most important thing in all of investing, is that every second of the day you are cashing out your portfolio and choosing to reallocate every penny of your money in those stocks that you decided not to sell that second. Does that not make sense to you guys?
It does make sense. Yeah, it does make
sense. Why the hell does no one else? I've been saying this for 20 years to every person I meet, and they look at me like I'm insane. And I'm like, I wrote an article for Motley Fool back when that was actually a normal financial media company in the, I think it was the late 90s, or maybe it was 2001 or 2000. No, I take that back. It was early 2000s, very early 2000s. I wrote an article because they asked me to be a guest writer. And I was like, fine, I'll write an article. And I wrote that article and I sent it to them. They wouldn't publish it. They wouldn't publish
it. No way.
Yeah, so we'll F off, dude. You guys are imbeciles, obviously, because your brain can't compute what is the most obvious thing that anyone has ever said related to financial markets or investing. And I wish I could. I wonder if I have that on like a weird old drive someplace. I'd love to find that article.
I mean, I feel like it's like the same thing that makes people completely miss out on your Apples and your Nvidias and your Amazons and your Teslas, right? It's kind of like that similar thing. It's a logical approach and it's obvious in hindsight, but it's just for many people, it's just difficult to process that kind of information when it's in front of them. I mean, it's just, you know, I missed the boat on Palantir. I missed the boat on Nvidia. I just wasn't looking at it the way I should have looked at it. And that's, at least I didn't miss the boat on Tesla. I'm thankful for that one. But it's almost like my brain can only process one of these at a time too, you know? But it is a very interesting thing to think through, because that's literally the decisions we're all making as investors every day. Maybe subconsciously, but we don't think about it that way. Or at least that's how we should be thinking about it, you know?
Absolutely.
It's interesting.
All thinking about that way.
Yeah. Go ahead, Hans.
I'm curious why, in your opinion, like that is basically the valuation or the value investor camp has basically taken over the entire investing world. They're trying to follow Warren Buffett. And I'm just curious why you think everyone wants to follow Warren Buffett when there are so many tech investors who have done so much better than him by investing in disruptive innovation in the future instead of trying to buy something good at a discount.
Yeah, so that's my other biggest pet peeve, right? So like the whole Warren Buffett, intelligent investor, all the stuff, right? Like all the old school stuff. It stuns me. It stuns me that people continue to think like that. And, you know, I studied Warren Buffett. I've studied every major investor of the last century, right? Like, you know, there's not an investor or investment style I haven't researched deeply. And I have a tremendous amount of respect for Warren Buffett. Tremendous. But man, talk about an individual, an investment style that has not made sense for a very long time. He has had so many advantages the last 25 years. I mean, he has access to things that no investor would ever have access to. I mean, just go back to the 2008, right? Like the deals that he was able to put in place, like the access he has. He has missed so much. For a person that could have access to the world, that should be completely crushing it the last 25 years, right? He went through a long period of time when he literally didn't, not only did he not, but he wasn't with it enough for whatever reason in his later years to understand that he needed to empower someone else to understand what technology was, to miss out on a bulk of the technology revolution, which was the biggest investment of even his lifetime. It could have been, like, he already had plenty of big ones, right, that he did not miss out on, but that could have been like the most, with the amount of capital he had and the resources he had and the access he had. Could you imagine if Buffett was not asleep at the wheel during those years and would have been involved in that?
Crazy.
Could you imagine the power and the size of that, of his entity today?
I can't, actually.
I mean, fortunately, he eventually, because listen, I will say this. I mean, like I said, I have tremendous respect for him. He was smart enough to kind of eventually figure it out and make a monstrously huge investment in Apple. And again, people said, oh, he's too late. No, he wasn't too late, right? He's proven that now. But I also respect him in so many other ways outside of it. But people look at Buffett and they're like, oh, you know, this is the guy. Like, no. He was definitely the guy to be watching and learning from and following at a certain point in time. Peter Lynch was the guy for a long period of time that you want to be following and learning from. Books like The Intelligent Investor were magical for a long period of time. But the world adapts, right? The world changes, markets change, the way opportunities change. And that no longer works anymore. It just doesn't. It just mathematically doesn't. You just look at returns. It doesn't. Now, I started trading a certain way in the mid-2000s, this thing called info arb, social arb. And for the past 17 years, it's the number one way in the world to trade. It's not debatable. Yeah, I mean, look at my, you know, I think I average like 70 some odd percent annualized returns going on my 17th or 18th year now. So as kind of the ringleader of this methodology, it certainly is no longer debatable. Will this methodology be the best one to apply in 10 years? I have no idea. I've always said, I'm always looking behind me thinking, when will the rest of the world really catch on to what I'm doing? And what I'm doing becomes exceptionally difficult. By the way, I will admit that in the crypto world, this is how crypto traders trade. Like they trade like the way I trade in equities. And so people are always like, why don't you trade crypto? Why don't you get on Solana coins? Why don't you? I'm like, why would I want to compete with exceptionally sharp, quick moving minds who are completely consumed with information, monitoring things at lightning speed to arbitrage them in that world, when I could compete with millions of people that are still reading The Intelligent Investor and trying to mimic Warren Buffett, like in equity markets, right? Like, why would I pick the hardest competition when the competition in equity markets is still so slow, so antiquated? Like, that's why I love trading equities, because my competition...
And much bigger, too. And it's a much bigger market.
It's a much bigger market. And here's the thing, guys. Like, I'm definitely not the sharpest mind in the world, right? Like, I don't even really allocate that much of my life to trading. Like, I'm older. I have a family. I like doing fun stuff. I own a couple restaurants. I have fun. I'm like... I like to consider myself a super dad, because I spend, you know, usually at all the soccer games and all this stuff, it's like I'm the, you know, it's me and a few dads and a ton of moms, you know, like I love doing that. So I prioritize that. So I miss a lot. I can't even tell you how many, you know, trades I've missed because I was just distracted. There's a reason why we only do one YouTube show a week, and sometimes we go 2 weeks without doing a Dumb Money Live. Sometimes we'll go 3 weeks without doing a Dumb Money Live, because Dave is hanging out at his house in Mexico. I'm doing family stuff. Jordan's doing, you know, the stuff. Like, we're not 70, 80 hour a week traders, right? That's not what we do. So how crazy is it that I'm still generating these returns, kind of doing this stuff just for fun, part-time, because I love it. I enjoy it.
Yeah. Yeah, it really just speaks for itself. It speaks for itself. You know, I think for people that really, really want to get familiar with your approach and really understanding how you're viewing all this stuff, they really got to make sure they check out dumbmoney.tv on YouTube, Dumb Money Podcast. Just really great stuff, and make sure they follow you at Chris Camillo as well on X. Let me hit you with a question here before we have to wrap up.
Yeah.
On the, you know, sort of on the bot topic. The one thing that I've been thinking through that's been sort of eye-opening as well when it comes to the adoption of this technology is, if you're thinking about the other type of AI applications that are in the hardware space. So the one that comes to mind immediately is self-driving technology. Like, if you take Tesla's approach to trying to solve self-driving technology, it's sort of the similar end-to-end approach that they're looking to put in the humanoid bot sort of applications, right? In over time, they want to put the AI brain in the bot. Doesn't really need it, but FSD, Tesla thinks, as an example, that the AI brain is needed to be a general purpose self-driving car where you can just drop and play basically anywhere in the world. Wow. But the self-driving technology piece has a huge roadblock, which is regulation. Regulation is a very, very hard thing that Tesla is going to and other players that want to use that kind of technology, they have to run through, because there are these are just rockets on wheels, basically, and something bad happens, you could potentially cause mass havoc and death, right? But I don't get the sense that human or robots are really going to have much of an issue from a regulatory perspective, because they can be confined, number one, they can be very controlled. And it's, at the start at least, it's much more of a business-to-business type product, a B2B type product, which is not going to be subject to as much regulation. And so the adoption of this technology, to me, feels like it's going to be really, really quick, because as soon as a business says, I understand how this thing is going to make me a lot more money by dramatically lowering my costs, and I don't have to really worry about human labor. The regulatory process, I don't, like, what is there? Like, I feel like there's really nothing there. There isn't any.
To my knowledge, yeah. There isn't any. There could always be some kind of anti-humanoid movement, right? But that will, they'll get around that, because you're not going to stop machinery. You can't ban or tax machinery. Like, so you take the head off? Is it all right, we don't have an arm anymore. We have a thing coming out of the middle. It's like what? That's so dumb. I will say I've been massive skeptic on autonomous driving for a long time, not because I don't think it will eventually be huge. I do think it will eventually be huge. But because of the timelines, and I think the hurdles for, robo-taxi, autonomous driving, I think they're bigger than just regulatory. I think the TAM, there are question marks there. I think the TAM eventually is massively, massively, massively large. But I think at least in terms of robo-taxis, there are a lot of people that still want their own, that will always want their own cars. People with kids, for example, right? Like there's like a billion reasons why you want your own car. It doesn't mean they won't all be autonomous, and you can't generate autonomous software revenue off of them, right? But the concept of everybody moving to a robo-taxi model, which a lot of people say will happen, I think are thinking kind of in a silo, and they have not experienced or really thought deeply about the way all humans live. And, you know, every mom with a family and kids and car seats and toys and this, and so is not going to be taking stuff in and out of robo taxis every morning. They're literally in and out of a car 18 times a day. Okay. So now, will that mom eventually move to an autonomous car? Absolutely. I think that's more likely, but does it need to happen immediately? No. Do people enjoy driving to something? Absolutely, they do. So I think the timelines have always been really out of whack. Not just for regulatory, not just for getting over the 99.9998 hump, which we're still working on, by the way. But then then you have the regulatory hump. Then you have the human behavior hump of interest. Then you have, like, there's so many kind of different things that you have to get through that I always thought it was a multi-decade journey, as opposed to low single digit years, which everyone has been saying forever. So it's exciting, but not even remotely close to embodied AI, humanoids, robots, because I just see none of it there. I see virtually none of it. Now that this conversation has kind of started to move beyond commercial industrial use to home use, very little, but we're starting to see a little bit of it. I can't even tell you the number of people, the number of reaction I've gotten, like from moms that want it. Like as soon as people are like, oh yes. Like just imagine just a bot going around, cleaning the house, picking up kids' stuff. Just
fold my clothes. Fold my clothes.
just wash, hang, fold, organize the closet. Just like, just keep the kids' rooms and the hallways and the family room clear of stuff. Like just that, and that alone of picking up and organizing and laundry and dishes, if you don't go any further than that, might be the most prolific invention of our lifetime for anyone that has, especially families, right? And so there's virtually zero regulatory risk there. There's virtually zero risk in terms of people saying, hey, I'm not okay with that. Right. And pretty much everybody's okay with it. Like, are you kidding me? It's like a Roomba times 10 billion. Yes. Everyone's going to be like, yes, give it to me for the right price. I want it. But you're right. For the first decade, we don't even have to talk about that. There's enough commercial industrial demand for many, 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 many hundreds of millions. And from an economic model, and again, if you go back to my tweet thread at Chris Camillo that's pinned, you know, we're looking, you know, somewhere in the range of $75,000 to $125,000 a year right now is the best estimate we have of what these humanoids will be leased for commercial use. Because if you really want to break down the actual value of what they're bringing to a commercial client, in some cases, it can be as high as $350,000 a year. So, and again, I want to make something very clear. This is not displacing humans. This is like in addition to the humans. Most of these companies that I'm aware of that are trying to get allocation and on wait lists for these humanoids are not like, I can't wait to get rid of the, like, that's not what they're doing. They're all trying to figure out how they can grow and get stability in physical workforce that they can't get today, how to add additional shifts, how to get more out of their factories, how to get more out of their facilities. Virtually nobody is looking at firing people and replacing them with humanoids. In time, will that happen? It's probably inevitable, but by then, I think our civilization and society starts to shift to people generally not wanting those jobs anyway. And that opens up a whole new conversation about the age of abundance and what that actually looks like. To where, listen, most humans do not want to do the jobs we were doing 100 years ago, right? We just don't want to do it. Do people do it? Yes. Are there still people working in fields? Absolutely they are. Do the majority of Americans want to go out and live their life working in the fields, right? Picking fruit? Absolutely not. Doesn't mean we still have people doing it. Do people want to do that if they don't have to? No. All right. So this is just the evolution of mankind, right? Like we will in 40 years, and we're accelerating our innovation, right? And pace of change. So it could be in 20 years, in 25 years, we'll look back at what we thought was work, you know, or we'll look forward. If we could look, of our current day selves can look forward at what we're doing 25 years from now, we'll be like, well, they're not even working. Nobody has jobs anymore. Why do so few people have jobs? And they would look back and be like, what are you talking about? We all have jobs. These are our jobs. We're doing amazing, difficult things with our lives and productive things for society. Of course, we all have jobs. The same way that someone 50, 60, 70 years ago would be like, wait, you're posting memes for a living? You're posting, you're coming up with social media? Like, that's not a job. Yeah. Like, of course it's a job. I manage my own media network. What are you talking about? I manage this for 10 companies. Like, what do you mean? Of course it's a job.
Imagine telling a person 1,000 years ago there's a dog walking job.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Right. And yeah. I don't know why it's so hard for people to wrap their head around the fact that, yes, jobs will eventually get displaced, but we've always displaced jobs. And you know what happens when we displace jobs? In every instance in human history, we create more, not less. We create more opportunity, not less. There's always more opportunity, and it's better than the opportunity that existed in the past. So is this the first time that doesn't happen? I wouldn't bet on it.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that the discussion would love to have you back for in the future if you're up for it, is like that transitionary period is the one that really, that's really interesting as we move from today to future. How we adopt the resistance movements, the displacement level, the speed of the displacement, so on and so forth, that always makes a very sort of interesting thing to think about, because if you can create a quasi-infinite supply of human labor at some point, once you get the factories ramped up and you get sort of the software figured out, then you can, I mean, en masse, these things start showing up after some point, right? And what does that mean to the sudden shift and whatnot? But anyway, we can leave that for another day, because I know you got to go.
As a closing note, you know, I want to, you know, let people know, like, everyone's like, well, what should I be thinking about? What should I be investing? What should I be doing? Like, the most important thing right now to do is everybody should be spending at least 30 minutes or an hour a week Just continuing to educate themselves on this embodied AI movement, humanoids specifically. You know, there's at least a dozen or so YouTubers. There are people to follow on Twitter. You could set Google alerts for articles that mention humanoid. You know, read a few articles a week, watch a couple YouTube episodes a week, read a few, you know, follow some of the people on X that are talking about this stuff. I mean, feel free to follow me at Chris Camillo at, you know, Dumb Money TV as well. But just if you just do that, you will know what's going on in the space. You will know when the right time is to go all in. And you just have to start retraining your mind on what's actually happening, because your mind's not going to want to let anyone believe this. And the only way you're going to believe it is through massive exposure to it, regular daily exposure to this. I'm telling you, there's nothing bigger that's ever happened, I don't think, in my lifetime in terms of investment opportunities. And we're not even sure what those investment opportunities are going to be yet. It might not even be the humanoid companies. It might be the companies that will benefit from infinite human labor, right? So start thinking about that right now. But if you're not thinking about this, then you're not in the game. You're going to miss out. The same way that you might have missed out on the, you know, earliest days of the AI appreciation, all right, in companies like NVIDIA. So that's it. By the way, dumbmoney.tv has all the socials for me, my two partners, Jordan and Dave. We have our YouTube show every couple of weeks, Dumb Money Live on YouTube. And you guys are great with everything that you're doing. So just keep doing it. And I'm happy to come on and have a more in-depth talk, because like we didn't really get in-depth at all about, and I maybe we delay that a little bit because I'm trying to get clearance about what I'm allowed to talk about and not talk about.
For sure.
So once I'm allowed to talk about more of what I have exposure to and have seen, I think that could be pretty interesting stuff. So I'm going to try to get those approvals between now and the end of the year.
Awesome.
And hopefully I can come back and have a more in-depth conversation.
We would absolutely love that. Hans and I and our audience would definitely appreciate that. Chris, thank you so much for making the time, dude. This was awesome.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Thank you.
At Chris Camillo on X, dumbmoney.tv, dumbmoney on YouTube. Make sure you go check him out. Thank you, everybody. I'm going to hit recording here and recording if you can hang for